Now they have formed different organizations.
Maybe you should let some other people speak.
Yeah. Just actually after this, we'll just move on. So what actually the lower caste people are doing? And here it's interesting that how the lower caste in India, they are boycotting all those things in the terms of rituals, festival, and how the dominant hegemony, the religious hegemony in India, they call it Hindu hegemony. And so this is a popular festival in southern part of India, which they kind of boycott. And then in this whole higher education process, the food becomes a kind of very contentious issue. And people are, as you know, that beef is banned in India because it's a religious it's not supposed to be, because cow is sacred in India. And now these lower castes in India, the Dalits, they are actually taking food as a issue to protest and see what's happening. They started celebrating beef festival, and then as a result, you know, see the kind of repression then they face. So these are the processes which is happening in India at that level, where identity issues are emerging at from a very different angle. And here you see in India, in Hindu religion, these people, okay, we have 2 minutes, okay, the those people who are presented as devil, you know, in every religion. So now these students are, they're celebrating that evil, the so-called evil or devil, and they are kind of glorifying that tradition. They said, why we are called Asura, you know, that, you know, those people who are marginalized, they are the one who are called devil. So this is how the process is changing, and they celebrate the other side of the culture, which is projected in history as a negative side. So these are some of the things which I wanted to highlight. See, in fact, they are burning the old historic text and make a point that these are the texts which actually kept us marginalized, and now it's the time to reassert. So this is within the higher education, these movements are going on. And this one of the philosopher, a scholar, who's posing this question. He said, why should I worship the God who doesn't speak my language? Because we have so many language, and the God used to speak in Sanskrit, and Sanskrit was never actually made available to the lower caste in India. But now when there are still places in India where lower caste are banned, they are not allowed to enter in the temples. So in that case, lower caste students in higher education are taking a lead and making a point that we are boycotting your gods. So there are these processes going on. At the same time, what connects US and India is that,
I mean, really, don't
they
you
are
think it's too much? I mean,
okay.
Hang on 1 second. Yeah.
Let me just wrap it up. What connects India and US is that now lower caste in India are taking the reference of the black activism here, and they are forming, like I said, Black Panther, and they made a Dalit Panther there. Then you had black literature, so they developed Dalit literature over a period of time. And now you have Black Lives Matter, we have Dalit Lives Matter there. So this is the connection, what I'm saying. That's how the identity is reasserted in higher education. And so this is a kind of hegemony against hegemony, the religious or the administrative hegemony in higher education. I think so. These are the processes I wanted to discuss, and maybe we can discuss more during the question and answer session.
Okay, thank you very much. We have a lot on the table now, I think. And I do want to come back to the student activism part, which is a central topic here. So I want to ask Mark whether, after listening to especially Sam's presentation and responses, whether you want to take a couple of minutes to respond, and then I'm going to open it up to here.
I'm not convinced by Sam's argument. I've heard it too often, that there's this movement and that movement, and you know, and a lot did come out of Occupy. For example, you mentioned a movie, Examined Life, by Esther Taylor. Mm-hmm. Well, Esther Taylor was an Occupy person who founded something called the Rolling Jubilee. And what that is, was a movement against student debt. And that's very important. I agree. So these things are happening. But, I mean, I hope you're right. I hope you're right. But Gaurav is raising a question of identity politics in India, with implication onto identity politics in the United States. You said that, right? And I myself, I'll give you an example. I have been called out in a year ago as being a racist because I got in a habit of telling everybody what I thought. Well, I got away with it for many decades in Albuquerque, New Mexico, because of my history. I ran with the Black Panthers, right? I was a weatherman, all that stuff. Well, now the statute of limitations has run out on all that, and I'm just another old, fat, rich, white guy. And who am I to tell black people, or Hispanic, or actually in one case Arabic, Palestinian people, anything at all? And I realized that they're right. That there's some kind of a continuum. This is really what I think you're talking about. Between justice on the one hand and unity on the other. See, the big problem that we have while we pursue the justice of recognizing black people's oppression in this country, or the justice of recognizing Dalit oppression, which has never been recognized in India. Never. That people, I don't know if you're aware of this, nobody ever talks about it in India. I once approached an Indian colleague of mine. I said, could we talk about the untouchables in India? We were eating lunch together. She packed up her lunch and got up and left. You don't talk about it. India's worse than the United States in a certain way. But so there's the justice of raising all this identity politics. But then there's the absolute fact that no group can ever win alone. Mm-hmm. We must have coalition to get anywhere, social democracy or even basic human rights. There has to be coalition. So if we're spending all our time calling out our potential allies and calling them names and alienating them, which I think is some of the stuff you were talking about, then we're wasting that potential. What I'm saying is there's a continuum and a balance between justice, I'm oppressed and you don't recognize it, and the need for unity. And I'm actually hopeful. I think we're going through this.
We will take some time.
I invited my class to come here, so I feel a responsibility to have them engage in the conversation. The issue you were raising about history and the relationship that they should have with history, I want to suggest that we open up the discussion and kind of
right. I was letting you respond because no,
I'm worried that my class is running out in a few
right.
minutes.
Oh, but I think but half an hour.
Oh, okay.
There's half an hour.
Oh, okay.
Left.
That's fine. But I want to I want to center this relationship between the history, which we fairly much know.
Mm-hmm.
And the students and where do they fit in this history? And I wonder if you can talk about what is it about your experience that is a teachable moment, if you like. What is it that you did right, and what is it that you did wrong? and have them engage.
Can I answer that question? Because I was at Columbia in 1968, and I was one of the leaders of SDS at that point. And I'd like to point a counter
position. Okay, just a quick comment. Sure.
Mark, you don't mind me saying that, will you? Okay.
You were colleagues, okay. Right.
We were political enemies and allies in the struggle.
Factional. Faction fighting.
I mean, basically, one of the big contributions to the Columbia struggle was it created the concept of an alliance between the community and the students, basically. And that history has continued. Today, you have, like, worker-student alliance groups on campus all across the country. Here you have the Progressive Student Union, which helped organize campus workers. You have at Georgetown, the Georgetown Solidarity Committee. So the idea of getting beyond just simply a student movement and reaching out to the working class was an important idea that was developed at Columbia. It's what made this struggle at Columbia successful, because we got the community, we got the black students, we got the white students all on the same page. Without that type of unity, the Columbia strike would have ended on the first day, and it would have arrested 100 or so white students, and it would have been over with, basically. So I think that, you know, that's a little bit of the history which we need to do. One other quick point. To deal with these problems, fundamentally, we have to get rid of capitalism. That's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And to get rid of capitalism, you have to build a communist movement, which can take power from the capitalists. The only way that's going to happen is you have to learn the histories of what went wrong in the histories of that revolutionary movement over the last 100 years. Correct those mistakes and get on with the task of rebuilding that type of movement. So I'm a member of the Progressive Labor Party. I've been in it for 50 years. We have a lot of pretty good ideas. If you want to talk more about it, I'm more open to the discussion. Thank you.
Okay. All right, Mark. Any... Going back to
what lessons from your story?
But we have a student question. I'm much more interested in the student questions.
I am a Chinese, so by hearing what you said, I can't really just sit here and just hear it out. I just want to ask you, do you know when did this Tiananmen Square thing happen?
1989?
Yes, and when is now? That's 30 years ago.
Right.
So I understand, like, from your perspective, that probably was a really something you can't just bear, or you need to express all your feelings. But there's one thing that 30 years has passed, and a lot of things has changed. And now in China, I'm a senior now, so in this 4 years here, I just find out even now there are a lot of people who don't really know what's happening in China. And there's a lot, like, stereotype, that's how we Chinese students think, happening here. And there are a lot of different perspectives, and the Chinese culture and American culture is so different. Mm. So there's just one, like, example, like, we know that Gorbachev from the Soviet Union kind of just declared that Soviet Union collapsed. Mm. So for a lot of people, like, around the world, we think that's a good thing. Mm. And the Nobel Peace Prize actually gave it to Gorbachev because he ended the Cold War. But for Russian people, there are a lot of Russian people saying that Gorbachev was not good enough, because if the Soviet Union still exists now, then their life may be better off. Mm. So I'm thinking, I don't think that you're completely wrong. Mm. But from different perspectives, I just want to say that please respect that there are a lot of probably Chinese culture that is not so familiar with, like, to the American society. Right. I understand you guys may not like what happened in China at that time, but please don't leave that impression till now and think China is still like that. That's
okay, thank you for that information.
Do you mind if I ask her a question?
Yeah,
actually,
sure.
Could you tell me your name, please?
I'm Wan Tong.
Wan Tong Sha. Wan Tong Sha. Yep. Am I saying it okay?
Yes.
One of the things I find useful in conversations of this kind, Wan Tong, is there are two kinds of conversations. One, I don't mean to even remotely disrespect you as a person. Having said that, conversations that we are having are about macro systems. So I'm from India. It hurts me when there's criticism about India. Mm-hmm. And I didn't grow up in the US. I came here just 2 years ago. Having said that, my concern for India does not allow me to be silent when there is injustice happening in India. So I also think what we are facing right now at a global level is a clash between more liberal, and I don't mean capitalistic, more liberal democratic societies and more authoritarian societies. This is happening in many parts of the world, not just China. I just use China as one example. I do recognize that there is a lot to be said for Chinese culture, particularly about harmony, particularly about the values of 5,000 years of Chinese civilization, which the West and India can learn a lot from. Having said that, I am personally very concerned about the lack of individual rights, the lack of freedom of expression. I worry about the treatment of Uyghurs and the surveillance state that's happening there. So I find it useful, and I'm just suggesting to you that as an academic, if you are able to distinguish between your personal identity as well as the larger processes, it would be useful for everybody, including you. And I'd love to learn more about China offline, talking to you. Okay?
Thank you. I'm trying to do that as well. Just
thank you.
Because I'm sorry to say that, but what you said, probably you're like so
passionate
about
yes.
that. So yeah, it felt a little bit offensive.
Okay. Sorry.
Thank you. Thank you for telling me that.
All right.
But no.
All right, good exchange. Okay.
Behind you, there's someone.
Sorry, behind me? Yes. Can you just identify yourself? Whoever asked the question, please identify themselves.
Dave Onsbach, no affiliation, retired. A question for speakers there. I think, forgive me, I mispronounced the name. Narendra Modi, is that his name?
Yeah.
Modi.
Mm-hmm.
Has he given indication, as part of, I guess he's Hindu nationalist from what I understand, has he given indication of institutionalizing and legalizing the caste system and discrimination against the Dalits in India in any way, similar to what used to happen in the United States with African Americans under Jim Crow? I'm just wondering if he's indicated that at all. Thanks.
Should we collect to mention? Yeah.
Any other? Yes.
So I also come from
student.
Student.
Okay.
I also come from China, but the other China, the Republic of China, is Taiwan. And so Taiwan or like Republic of China is also a liberal democracy. And
could you stand up, please? I'm having a hard time hearing. Thank you.
Alright. So I grew up in a liberal democratic environment, and I must say I must disagree with her statement about because of cultural difference. Therefore, mainland China cannot grow democracy. Because in my opinion, or my philosophy, I don't think massacring thousands of students can be justified by any reasons, including cultural difference. And in fact, from what I learned, ancient Chinese philosophy always talks about loving and caring to others, including Confucianism. So if you really look at Chinese philosophical development, I don't think there's any cultural link to justify government or regime, one party or the ruling class to massacre tons of people. And Taiwan, the Republic of China, will also experience authoritarian dictatorship during the 20th century. And so also a student activist in Taiwan is really active and really positive, though I sometimes don't agree with their opinions. And there's a concept called transitional justice. So this where and when our government, now the liberal democratic government, try to know and figure out what happened during the dictatorship. There was white terror, there was massacres against people who didn't agree with the government, and we are doing relatively well. We form a civic society, which there are lots of conversation going on and discussing what justice is and bring back the true history. And I'm Chinese and I speak Mandarin, and we also learn about Confucianism and any other Chinese philosophy. And I don't think there's any contradiction between dictatorship. Are there just any link between Chinese traditional culture with dictatorship? To be honest, I think Chinese philosophy is fundamentally against authoritarian regime or one-party state. So that's my experience from another Chinese perspective.
Thank you. as a moderator, I'm not sure that I heard anyone say that there was a cultural connect between authoritarianism and culture. So I think that, I don't think anybody was suggesting that. But the political system is what they're talking about, since we're talking about political democracy. But thank you for that. We just had former vice president from Taiwan, Annette Liu, yesterday here, student activist who went to jail for 6 years to change Taiwan's authoritarian system. So it's very relevant, actually, the Taiwan example. But okay, so we had one. Just to go back to your, is there any other questions? This is your moment.
Could I say
you
something?
You want to ask?
You know, it's very interesting. I just had a mind-blowing experience. I spent a week in Shanghai at the International Studies Institute of Shanghai University. And my whole life, I've studied the Chinese Revolution. Ever since I was a little kid. Have you ever read Red Star Over China by Edgar Snow? He was an American reporter who in the 50s wrote about the Chinese Revolution. And I was in junior high school, and a miracle happened one day, and Edgar Snow was there for our assembly in Maplewood, New Jersey. And the teachers were really angry because he was pro-communist. So I went to the library and I found his book. And it was called Red Star Over China. And I was like 12 years old and I started reading about it. So, whoa, that's incredible what's happening in China. It's just the most amazing thing that ever was. That the peasants, hundreds of millions are rising up, and so that started me at the age of 12 reading about the Chinese Communist Revolution, and I spent a lot of time talking to people and reading about it, and then in 2018 I got an invitation to go to Shanghai University to a conference called Global 1968. I can finally go to China. Isn't this cool? I've never been to China. I've read about it my whole life. It's so cool. But they tell me, talk about anything you want to talk about 1968, but don't mention the Cultural Revolution.
Yeah, exactly.
And in fact, they told me, we really don't have any Chinese history between 1962 and 1978. And I thought to myself, what the fuck is this? There's no Chinese history between 1962. This is not an attack on China. This is what happened. So when they told me I can't talk about the Cultural Revolution or the Gang of Four, in China there's a joke, the Gang of Four, right? I'm sure everybody knows that. The Gang of Four, get it? Right? Mao Zedong is the fifth. That's the big joke. So, all I could think about was the Chinese Cultural Revolution. And so I got my old copy of the Little Red Book, and in my talk, I talked about the importance of China to us. Do you know one of the biggest faction fights? We were involved in this faction fight where we waved the little red books at each other. That's true. We waved it, and I told this story, and the kids had never heard of it. They'd never heard of it. And I thought, what is this? They'd never heard of the little red book. They'd never seen one. So I showed them my copy, and they looked at it, and there was Mao Zedong with a little piece of tissue paper. There's a piece of tissue paper in the little red book because his picture is that important. Of course, you never see Mao Zedong's picture except on the money in China, but nobody uses money in China. Nobody uses currency. It's all iPhone. So the kids thought it was cool. Oh, incidentally, the kids, the students at the institute were never off their iPhones. Never. If this had been in China, everybody would have been on the iPhone all the time.